How to Save the World by Hassan Rashid. Like all the nomads before me who made tracks across the vast expanses of endless deserts, I search for the oasis where all can be quenched with sweet waters of wisdom. And if you ask me if I will reach that oasis in my lifetime, I will say, it doesn't matter. Definition. To save the world, it needs to return to a sustainable state. Sustainability is a broad concept referring to the ability to maintain or sustain something over time without causing harm or depleting resources. Generally, it applies to various domains, including Earth's environments, economies, and societies. To achieve sustainability of living on Earth, two principles need to be followed. The first is the recycling of matter. Recycling is by plants, mammals, birds, reptiles, insects, and microbes in a way that nothing is added or lost. The second is the stability through the balance of species populations, where natural birth rates are equal to natural death rates. For example, indigenous tribes such as the hunter-gatherer tribes take their role as partners in the cyclical recycling process along with the flora and fauna of the forest they find themselves in. This participation is through the belief systems that include them as part of the forest. Thus, these tribes have existed for thousands of years without harming their environments in any way. Before resources run out, they move on to other parts of the forest, allowing the environment where they had been to recover. In addition, their natural birth rates are offset by death rates through natural events such as old age, predation, or disease. Sustainability is not possible without both of these two principles. If the cyclical process of recycling matter is broken, then sustainability is impossible because the result is the accumulation of matter or its loss. For example, the acceleration of consumption of resources by one species in the cycle will cause a debilitating effect on the resource's regeneration and cause the consumers to suffer or become extinct. In addition, if the natural birth rates are not equal to the death rates, sustainability will not be achieved. For example, if birth rates are greater than death rates, overpopulation results and will precipitate an overconsumption of resources which cannot recover, resulting in the extinction of both resources and consumers. If death rates are greater than birth rates, the population will go extinct. Prologue. The Tourist by Unknown Author. A tourist went to Mexico and praised the local fishermen for the quality of their fish, then asked them, "How much time do you need to catch it?" The fishermen answered him in one voice, "Not long." He asked them, "Why don't you spend more time and hunt more?" The fishermen explained that their small catch was sufficient for their needs and the needs of their families. He asked them, "But what do you do in the rest of your time?" They answered, "We sleep late, we hunt a little, we play with our children, we eat with our wives, and in the evening, we visit our friends where we have fun, laugh, and repeat some songs." The tourist interrupted, "I have an MBA from Harvard University, and I can help you. You have to start fishing for long periods every day, then sell the extra fish for a greater return, and you buy a bigger fishing boat." They asked him, "Then what?" He replied, "With the big boat and the extra money, you can buy a second boat, a third, and so on, until you have a complete fleet of fishing vessels. Instead of selling your catch to a middleman, you will negotiate directly with factories, and perhaps you will also open your own factory. You will be able to leave this village and move to Mexico City, Los Angeles, or even New York. From there, you will be able to start your mega projects." The fishermen asked the tourists, "How much time will we need to achieve this?" He answered, "About 20, or perhaps 25 years. They asked, "What then?" He answered with a smile, "When your business grows, you will speculate in stocks and win millions." They asked him in astonishment, "Millions, truly? What will we do next?" He replied, "After that, you can retire. You live quietly in a village on the coast, sleeping late. You play with your children, and you eat with your wives. You spend your nights having fun with friends." The fisherman answered, "With all respect and appreciation, but that's exactly what we're doing now. So, what is the logic for which we waste 25 years of misery?" Introduction. Our complicated modern life. It isn't straightforward because it depends on technology. Technology has a life of its own, which is rapidly evolving and changing by the minute. We humans are having a hard time keeping up with it, which causes a great deal of stress, physically and mentally. You see, humans evolved to be hunter-gatherers, where they exercised their various instinctive talents in those venues. Instead, many of us today find ourselves behind a desk looking at a piece of flat plastic for hours. Others find themselves behind a machine trying to control it to do the work the boss wants them to do. Even day laborers who spend hours repeating one or two tasks over and over again go home, and all they want to do is eat and rest in front of a flat piece of plastic, trying to get their minds off to somewhere other than work. As a result, their bodies and minds turn into mush. Our brains are taking on many more responsibilities than they can or should handle. As a result, the United States of America has a mental health crisis. Not enough doctors or therapists in the field of mental health are produced a year to take care of the increasing demand. 6 in 10 practitioners reported that they no longer have openings for new patients. Nearly half, 46%, said they have been unable to meet the demand for treatment. And nearly three-quarters, 72%, have longer wait lists than before 2021. There are over 198,811 therapists and over 81,000 psychologists practicing in the U.S. as of August 16, 2023. Since 2020, about 30% of American adults have seen a therapist. In 2021, about 42 million people received treatment or counseling for their mental health. About 17% of American teens see a therapist each year. Every year, about 20% of working adults experience a mental health issue, such as depression or anxiety. Psychology Today, March 2024. Information overload in our brains is one reason for the crisis. We are bombarded by all kinds of different information that can't be stored and processed, yet we feel that we need to do so. It's like trying to fit a round peg in a square hole. For example, when we go to vote, we are expected to know the candidate's background and qualifications, and on top of that, we need to know things like economics or engineering, to name just two of many disciplines to make the right choices. Humans don't like change, and when they are confronted by a rapidly evolving technological world where it is do or die in your job, they encounter another source of stress. After years of trial and error, software engineers and implementers know that they have to involve the end user at the beginning of the project and have them involved in the development and implementation phases to have any success at all. Even then, 50% of projects fail when placed in the environment it is supposed to help because of the non-acceptance of the end user. No matter where you are, a person can't help but be exposed to all kinds of news sources from all over the world that we have no control over. This is a distraction from our local responsibilities and tasks. We suddenly are involved in other people's problems that we can't do anything about. Yet we have feelings and thoughts tied up in those events. Aboriginal people had none of this, and all they had to worry about was their local environment and family or tribe. Again, we come to a limit to the ability of our brain to cope. As a result, we lose the sense of our local communities and find discord in personal, family, and social affairs. We see an increase in conflict between family members and neighbors. To top it off, our economic system insists on putting a dollar value on everything it comes in contact with. This erodes any real appreciation for the value of a family or community. There was a time when mothers demanded to be paid for their services. Unfortunately, this puts a price on something that is beyond any price for the local community or the wider nation. Our technological invention, the economy, has placed zero value on anything natural. To the economy, a tree out in the forest has a value of zero and only gains value when touched by the economy. This brings us to our natural environment and our concern for its health and well-being. More on this is coming later in this publication. We all participate in the economy, which essentially degrades the environment on one hand, and on the other, we care to have a healthy one. This paradox places a lot of stress on our brains. Another invention that is a codependent of technology is our belief system, which also puts a great deal of stress in our lives, if you ask a psychiatrist or psychologist. It seems that all the moral codes we are taught often go against our basic instincts and are one of the causes of stress in our lives. These codes make us work together to form a cohesive working society, and on the other hand, This cohesiveness amplifies the negative effects of lashing out by our instincts. In conclusion to the introduction, technology is a double-edged sword, as they say. On one hand, it has allowed us to build monuments to ourselves, and on the other, it has taken a toll on our physical and psychic well-being. We will show later in this publication, it took a terrible toll on the environment as well. The question is, was or is it worth it? Was there a time when none of this stress was in our lives? The answer is, yes. This publication covers two opposing points of view of life on Earth. One view is of the Earth and its life forms as a product of nature. The other is the view that the artificial technological environments we are creating are products of the inner self of the noble human species. The big question here is, why are humans expending labor and toil to create technological environments when nature has already provided natural ones for free? Section 1. Earth is a product of nature. Life is a natural thing. Nature is like a Rubik's Cube. The little qubits move up and down, left and right. If you know this, then getting the colors together in order can pretty much happen in a jiffy. If you don't know this, it might take you a while or even forever to solve it. Unfortunately, nature is much more complicated than a Rubik's Cube. It has characteristics that humans can't understand, but we will leave that subject to much later in this publication. The closest you can get to the characteristics of nature is by taking a course in physics. If that does not turn you on, try a course in chemistry. And if that is a bummer, too, try a course in biology. These disciplines will train you in observation, experimentation, to find out the unknown, and the attempt at making conclusions about your findings. Suffice it to say that we have been doing this for hundreds of years, and we still have little clue as to how nature works. Species before humans did not bother with these thoughts and simply followed nature in everything they did. When it was time to hunt, they hunted. When the urge for the erotic act took over, they did not resist. When it was time to migrate, they migrated, and so on. They did not ask questions about what they were doing either. They simply did them. Life uses the sun's energy. From the three disciplines of physics, chemistry, and biology, we learned that nothing happens without some energy. Energy is the transfused lifeblood of the earth from the sun. If it was not for energy, the first life molecule, DNA, would not have happened, and there would be no life like what you see every day on earth. Without the sun's energy, there would be no days or nights to start the earth's bio dance in the morning and calm it down when the sun disappears. In the absence of energy, there would be no primary food source available from Earth's flora to feed the fauna. Without herbivores, there would not be carnivores or omnivores, and certainly no humans. Without flora flourishing in the sun, there would not be any structural materials for birds to build their nests. There would not be any insects hunting for their food or pupating. And as the Earth wobbly revolves around the sun, the seasons come into play, increasing the diversity of life on the only Earth in existence. Information in the form of DNA. Each atom in existence, and as far as we know, has a set of characteristics that govern how it interacts with other atoms and molecules. In turn, a molecule, combination of two or more atoms, has its own set of characteristics that govern its reaction with other atoms and molecules. It is the thought of many inquisitive people that the molecule DNA, diribonucleic acid, is an informational guide for development, construction, and some or most behaviors of the living. It is thought the first DNA was able to evolve into the estimated millions of flora and fauna species that existed just 100 years ago. The species that evolved up to, but not including humans, never knew that, did not need to know that, and simply did whatever they felt they needed to do, like find shelter, food, and mates. As a result, millions of species on Earth coexisted. Changes to DNA are by nature. Like any molecule, DNA has characteristics that govern how it behaves in its environment. It can grow, it can duplicate, segments of it can be benign or silent, and others can be effective in expression or expressed multiple times in an individual's or species' lifetime. In other words, the DNA molecule has a plethora of ways or characteristics by which it reacts to its environment and to itself. In addition, the environment can change the structure of DNA and thus its capabilities in the areas of individual development, structure, and behavior. These changes can come from the soil through toxins, from the air by way of toxins, by way of cosmic rays, or from the sun's energy packets hitting the DNA molecule. All these reactions are accomplished through their natural inherent characteristics. Nothing tells them what to do or what not to do. These environmental changes to DNA occur slowly, and only a very few ever result in a beneficial life change. Therefore, positive change occurs over thousands, if not millions, of years. The results of changes to DNA, since the inputs to the reactions in the previous sections are natural, the outcomes are natural too. As you might have guessed, some changes are detrimental to the individual involved, such as exposure to a toxin that debilitates or even leads to death. Other exposures may be beneficial and give the individual a new characteristic that allows them to develop or behave in a way that secures food, shelter, or a mate more successfully or with less energy. Go with the flow and meander, where there is least resistance. There was no goal to life before the advent of humans. It was all about characteristics and their interactions. The clock was not a factor in daily life. All events took their own time to complete. You see, evolution resulted in individuals that fit the environments. If an individual did not fit, then they would perish. There is no planning or designing involved. Evolution simply happens based on the characteristics of the environment, the individuals involved, and the availability of resources such as energy, among others. So, nature is a process of non-intent. If it stumbles onto a hard place, it simply goes around it. If it encounters a soft spot, it indulges it. If the right conditions exist, then evolution happens. Diversity of life. All this meandering of atoms and molecules resulted in ecosystems. A cultured human would be itching to say that these ecosystems were some sort of plan from the start, but the truth is that they were all spontaneous and unplanned. As it turned out, these ecosystems were the result of the characteristics of its species and environment. In turn, these ecosystems acted through their amalgam of characteristics, like individual species, and they multiplied throughout the Earth. In doing so, they increased the diversity of the biota of Earth by being exposed to new environments. From a single and small molecule of DNA 4 billion years ago came forth millions of species, represented by billions of individuals, all going about their business in a trillion directions, all obeying their inherited characteristics. Preservation of diversity. The millions of species in existence today are not on a journey to merge into a single unified species, but to preserve and enhance their uniqueness. That is the way the ecosystems maintain a balanced and cyclical relationship between their species. So how does change come about, and how is it preserved? The environment changes as a result of storms, volcanic activity, and tectonic plate movements, to name just a few examples, and species adapt to these changes as a result of mutations in their DNA. In addition, the segregation of a population segment caused by these environmental changes can reduce its contributions to the original collective gene makeup, gene pool, of the population. The isolated population now has a gene pool that over time undergoes genetic change as it adapts to its new isolated environment. The result is a change in both populations that may lead to two different races or species. In addition, when two races meet, when an isolation factor is no longer present, they may merge again, producing a new and different gene pool. The two races may have evolved differences in behavioral or physical characteristics, such as in the courting dance, or different feather colors, respectively, related to mating. This may lead to hybrids that may or may not be able to mate. If they are not able to mate, then two new gene pools with different makeups emerge, increasing the diversity of species in the combined environment. Thus, the diversity of species increases when left to nature. Earth's cyclical nature. It is no secret that nature in general makes things rounded or elliptical, such as the planets and their orbits, while humans create things that are mostly straight, square, or rectangular, such as their houses, towns, and agricultural fields. Sure, humans create round things like plates and rockets, but those are the exceptions. It is also true that nature creates jagged things like rocks, but those are on their way to becoming smooth and round again, thanks to rolling and tumbling due to weather, volcanic activity, or earthquakes. So, it should not be surprising that the following discussion revolves around natural cyclical concepts. First, we will discuss the cyclical nature of inanimate entities, and then we will move on to the living. Earth is a self-contained system. Hardly anything comes into it from outside except for sunlight and the occasional meteor. Rarely anything leaves the Earth except for a little reflected sunlight and an occasional molecule of air floating into outer space. What is the general logic of Earth's cycles? They help us explain how an atom or a chemical compound moves through its environment, starting in one part and moving to another, only to return to where it started with no or very little accumulation. There is an endless number of cycles taking place on and within the Earth right now. The cycle that can be perceived most readily is the water cycle, which begins in the oceans, lakes, rivers, and on land, as water vapor ascends through the air forming clouds. These clouds will, in turn, drift along until the moment they give in and fall in the form of rain, snow, or ice onto land to form streams, creeks, and rivers, eventually emptying into lakes and oceans, or else are absorbed by the land. The water cycle takes a year or more to reach completion, and other cycles may take less time or much longer. For example, Earth's crust consists of tectonic plates of rock, sand, and mud moving very slowly and colliding with one another. Science tells us that at their collision points, one plate with all its mud and sand can slip under another, producing extreme pressure and heat. This results in volcanic activity that throws molten rock from deep beneath up to the surface. The rock cools and over millions of years breaks down to mud and sand once again. Carbon dioxide also exists in the oceans, air, and underground. Carbon dioxide is balanced between the atmosphere and the oceans, as the atmosphere and the oceans exchange carbon dioxide according to their temperatures and composition. Scientists like to talk about these as carbon dioxide cycles. A major cycle in this regard is the photosynthesis respiration cycle of living matter in the biosphere. For plants, photosynthesis takes carbon dioxide and water to produce oxygen, sugars, and starches, which many, if not most of the living, depend on for energy. With respiration, the reverse can be observed. Oxygen and carbohydrates combine, releasing carbon dioxide and water again. The living cycles. In the simplest of terms, life is a chemical reaction requiring energy. With a fixed amount of incoming energy from the sun hitting our planet's surface, lowering the amount of energy required for this chemical reaction to take place allows for a proliferation of life. If the reader asks how they might lower the amount of energy required for a chemical reaction, the answer would revolve around the availability of catalysts, such as enzymes, which are the biological catalysts. In most cases where an enzyme is required, reactions occur faster because they require less energy to activate the reaction. You can think of a catalyst as a tool like a wrench, which makes it so much easier to unscrew a nut. So, increased energy efficiency using tools, such as an enzyme, occurs when mutations in our offspring lead to more efficient enzymes. As far as we are aware, the cycles discussed in the carbon dioxide cycles are neither the rule nor the exception for the movement of matter on and within the Earth's mantle. However, they are certainly present in each species in their circulatory systems. Specific groups of species, such as those found in a forest, circulate matter too. One can say that energy drives the circulatory system of forests. Without it, forests would collapse because each of its links, whether one species or a piece of inanimate matter, provides a tiny link in the larger overall forest chain or chains that provide a way to recycle life-giving nutrients. These recycling chains make these nutrients available for the regeneration of the forest. For example, on a smaller scale, when looking out a window or strolling through a park, the reader may observe trees, birds, grass, and bees, to name just a few of the life forms present in our surroundings. When focusing on a flower merely as an object, it may appear entirely independent of the other objects around it. Still, it is intimately connected with all other objects in its immediate vicinity. A clover, for example, needs soil to grow. As a mature plant, it later provides nourishment for the bison that roam the plains of the Midwest of the USA. The puma, meanwhile, later hunts out the bison for food. When it manages to bring one down, it drags what it can of the carcass to the shade of a tree to eat. Flies gather around the carcass to feed, lay eggs, and try to avoid the birds that feed on them. The above explanation is simplified, but it shows how different species are so closely interlinked. A more accurate representation of the cyclical link between species is shown in the following graphic. The graphic shows a circle with different species on its cusp. Each species is followed in a clockwise direction by an arrow. Starting on the left is a green shrub with an arrow pointing to the right to a goat, meaning that the shrub is the food for the goat. Another arrow points from the goat to a lion, meaning that the goat is the food for the lion, and so forth. The lion is followed in order by a fly, bird, amoeba, and a bacterium. Following the biological cycle explained above clockwise, starting with the green bush at the top left, a story can be told of how nutrients flow from one species to another. First, the bush extracts water and minerals from the soil, and with the help of the sun and atmosphere, produces tender leaves, some of which are consumed by the goat to build its muscle, maintain its growth, and hopefully also give birth. The lion consumes the goat in turn. The leftovers from the goat are used by the fly to lay its eggs. Some birds will feed on those flies, while the goat, lion, bird, and fly leave behind fecal matter that is consumed by various microbes, such as amoebas and bacteria, which return the nutrients to the soil once again. On any given territory, there are multitudes of life cycles, but perhaps with different species that participate in returning the atoms and chemical compounds, nutrients, to the soil and into the atmosphere. In addition, these living cycles can often be interrelated. For instance, a living cycle that starts with a bush can have more than one grazer consuming it. They may be goats, sheep, or deer. These living cycles can take on complex shapes. Looking at a square acre of land and trying to describe the number of living cycles within it, one may count many millions of combinations, and their arrangement may look like a ball of chains. Living cycles are not limited to food either. They can be observed in nest building, territory, and so on. To take the example of a bird building a nest in a tree, when the eggs hatch, the nest may fall to the ground where insects break it down and pass on the resulting matter to amoebas and bacteria, which will return the nutrients to the soil to be used by the bush. A forest is an example of an ecosystem. Like any ecosystem, it contains megacycles of circular chains involving the air, soil, water, plants, the sun, and animals. A forest is not the only ecosystem. A desert such as the Sahara Desert is also considered an ecosystem. In conclusion, life's cyclical nature. The chain of life is circular, meaning that there is no start or end, no top or bottom link, nor is there any intelligent link or any particularly unintelligent one. The chain is nevertheless very complex. It contains many circular side chains. You can imagine the chain as a solid sphere where no one circular chain can be distinguished from another. So, what keeps the ecosystem from collapsing if, for example, lions kill all of their available prey in a day or two? Balancing species populations. To have a balance of species, natural death rates must equal natural birth rates. When looking at the relationship between a lion and its prey, the gazelle for example, the African lioness eats from the herd of gazelle to satisfy her hunger. She hunts in a way that always leaves enough gazelle for her to pursue the next day and the next year. If she and her cohorts finished off the whole herd of gazelle, then her cubs will have nothing to eat the next day or year, and they will die off, resulting in their extinction. One key factor that gives stability to this living relationship is sleep. In the wild, it has been observed that lions sleep for 21 to 22 hours a day and go hunting for gazelle or other prey only when their bellies rumble. To conserve energy, lions pursue only the slowest individuals in the gazelle herd. If an element of sleepiness was not present in this pride of lions, one can imagine the lions hunting all day and bringing down as many gazelles as they can, which would ultimately break the living relationship between predator and prey by decimating both populations and lead to their extinction. Thus, sleepiness is a form of natural control characteristic of lions that ensures the survival of both the hunter and hunted. Other key factors to consider here are the territoriality of lions, where the larger the territory, the more gazelles there are to survive, and the increasing speed of gazelles that protects them against overhunting. So, living relationships are stable over time, largely due to the genetic characteristics of their participants, which have mutated into a form that fits the environment and ensures their survival. Unstable relationships in nature, such as when birth rates are not equal to death rates for the most part, are rare and most likely to collapse. The teeter-tatter of earthly life, this balancing act can be represented by a teeter-tater. For the species to survive, the teeter-tatter board must not touch the ground. If it does, the species will go extinct. You may ask how this balancing act is achieved. Imagine a balanced teeter-tatter for one species on the left side, such as a rabbit. The rabbit has a high birth rate, which would tilt down the teeter-tatter on the left, which is countered by a high death rate due to predation on the right side. So, as the birth of one rabbit happens on the left side, there must be a death on the other side of the teeter-tatter. If the species is a good hunter with a low death rate, then for it to keep the teeter-tatter in balance, it has the traits of a low birth rate. It just so happens, the lioness in the previous section has this trait. It should not be a surprise that two or more traits can help a species balance the teeter-tatter. For example, a gazelle has a higher birth rate and can outrun many of its many predators, resulting in a balanced teeter-tatter. The balancing act is not restricted to a single species, but may include two or more species. For example, there can be a balancing act between a predator and its prey, where a good hunter may sleep a lot, and the prey can run faster than the hunter, both traits reducing the appetite of the lion and the death rate of the gazelle. In the case of the lioness and the gazelle, we know that the gazelle also needs to eat. So in reality, we have a serial relationship involving two teeter-tatters. One is of the lioness and the gazelle, and the second is the gazelle in balance with the grass it feeds on, where the grass grows faster than the gazelle can eat it, keeping the teeter-tatter in balance. Here we have a predator who consumes prey, and in turn, the prey consumes grass. It is assumed that the grass needs water to grow. So far, we have not explored what will happen if anything unexpected happens. For example, what will happen if the rains stop and the grass dies? In this case, the gazelle dies off and their teeter-tatter becomes out of balance, and in turn, the lioness and gazelle teeter-tatter collapses, resulting in the micro-ecosystem collapsing. If the pride of lions only ate gazelle and the gazelle only ate grass, the result would be the extinction of the lions and gazelles. The good news is that many species are diversified in what they eat, so you might be able to imagine parallel teeter-tatters, where the lions also consume warthogs and the warthogs eat legumes instead of grass. You might say, if there is a drought one year, wouldn't the legumes also die out? The answer is yes, but the legumes have deeper roots, so they can access deeper groundwater and stay alive. The grasses leave behind seeds that can last for several years, so they will come back when the rains return. The imagery starts to get very complex when you consider an ecosystem where there are countless numbers of serial and parallel species teeter-tatters, or relationships, as biologists would put it. These relationships attest to the resilience of ecosystems, where if the unexpected happens, there are alternate cyclical and balanced paths that can be taken. To conclude Section 1, plants capture the energy from the rays of the sun and uptake water and minerals from the soil, which all cascade down to animals, insects, and microbes, where the original water and minerals in the life-giving resource are returned once again to the soil. This is the way it started and the way it has to continue on this planet. All species, large and small, whether as large as a whale or as small as an amoeba, deserve to live and have their habitats unspoiled for their own sake. They are not meant to be destroyed. They are meant to thrive. It will be shown in upcoming chapters that we must seek a simple lifestyle that pursues humble pleasures controlled by nature. We need to return to our original sun god for sustenance, happiness, and rebirth to prolong our days on this beautiful planet, for time will not be our enemy as it is today, but our friend. Section 2. Introduction of Humans. The boundaries of organic evolution on Earth existed in the interactions of DNA with the environment. However, modern humanity's thought processes created new boundaries, perceptions, and value systems that altered the course of this evolution. While nature resulted in the beauty that exists today in the mountains, valleys, and waterways, with millions of flora and fauna species adorning them, the current culture seems to be going in the opposite direction. The evidence shows that our culture has been reducing the diversity of the biosphere. Why? DNA now has challengers. DNA gradually evolved to form species with elaborate central nervous systems with large amounts of memory capabilities. This central nervous system, the brain, was unlike DNA, where the characteristics of the atoms that form it dictated the outcome. The brain had a different set of characteristics that allowed it to store environmental information gathered through sensory organs like the eyes and ears. In addition, the information stored could be manipulated to form new information or memories. The rules of this brain memory manipulation are yet to be discovered, but they are less stringent than those of DNA. For example, brain memory manipulation can be accomplished by simply combining two memories into one. DNA, on the other hand, requires that the atoms and molecules involved cannot be joined unless they possess the right atom characteristics and molecule shape. Cartoon films that take a year or two to design and produce might depict mice with human voices. This is something that DNA would not be able to do since it has no design or construction plans and depends on the characteristics of its constituent atoms. There are other characteristics of brain memory manipulation. They are quicker to form than those of DNA. To write a new poem may take a day or two, but to create a new species may take millions of years. To compound matters, when memory combines character images and words into an external document like a book, it solidifies the memory combination in the community, and so the creative fantasy, more often than not, is carried from generation to generation and eventually becomes a human-centric reality. In contrast, in the case of DNA, mutations go through two stringent tests at each new generation, one involving DNA's physical characteristics and the other of success in the environment. As a result, most DNA mutations eventually are not selected to go through to subsequent generations. However, the speed with which brain memories are formed, combined, communicated, documented, and passed on to the next generation allowed humans to invent and then call the invention reality after multiple generations. This will become clearer in subsequent chapters. The next chapter will involve the communication of memories orally. Subsequent chapters will involve the documentation of such memories in all their written forms and how that impacts the earth. The indigenous tribes, the tradition of oral communication. Humans 40,000 years ago participated in a cyclical relationship with nature and the balance of species communities. They took just enough for their livelihood, no more and no less, and moved on, allowing nature to replenish whatever they took. They acted like a pride of lions in that their behaviors did not take more than what other species could provide in the form of food and shelter without going extinct. From present-day indigenous peoples, we learn that this balanced relationship between humans and other species required they be in hunter and gatherer communities that moved from one area to another. The Forest People. The Forest People, Turnbull, Colin M., 1962. The Mbudi people live in the Ituri Forest, a tropical rainforest covering about 27,000 square miles of the north-northeast section of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Africa. Mbudi are pygmy hunter-gatherers and are one of the oldest indigenous people of the Congo region. They are composed of bands ranging from 15 to 60 people, with a population hovering around 30,000 to 40,000. The Ituri Forest has a high amount of rainfall annually, ranging from 50 to 70 inches. The dry season is relatively short, ranging from 1 to 2 months in duration. The forest is a moist, humid region strewn with rivers and lakes. The disease is prevalent in these conditions and can spread quickly, killing not only humans but major sources of food as well. Too much rainfall, as well as droughts, can greatly diminish the food supply. In the rainy season, they forage in part of the forest, and during the dry season, they expand their foraging territories. Their wild animal foodstuffs include crabs, shellfish, ants, larvae, snails, pigs, antelopes, monkeys, fish, and honey. The vegetable component of their diet includes wild yams, berries, fruits, roots, leaves, and kola nuts. While hunting, the Mbuti have been known to specifically target the giant forest hog, which is often considered quarry, a bad animal that may cause illness to those who eat it, and is commonly used as a trade good between the Mbuti and agriculturalist Bantu groups. Folklore has it that the quarry giant forest hog is nocturnal and a disruptor of the few imported agricultural activities the Mbuti practice. Mbuti societies have no ruling group or lineage, no overlying political organization, and little social structure. The Mbuti are an egalitarian society in which the band is the highest form of social organization. Leadership may be displayed, for example, on hunting treks. Men and women have equal power. Issues are discussed and decisions are made by consensus at fire camps. Men and women engage in the conversations equally. If there is a disagreement, misdemeanor, or offense, the offender may be banished, beaten, or scorned. The forest is the center of Mbuti life. They consider the forest to be their great protector and provider, and believe that it is a sacred place. They sometimes call the forest mother or father. An important ritual is referred to as Molimo. After the death of an important person in the tribe, Molimo is noisily celebrated to wake up the forest in the belief that if bad things are happening to its children, it must be asleep and not taking care of them. As with many Mbuti rituals, the time it takes to complete a Molimo is not rigidly set. Instead, it is determined by the mood of the group. Food is collected from each hut to feed the Molimo. And in the evening, the ritual is accompanied by the men dancing and singing around the fire. Women and children must remain in their huts with the doors closed. These practices were studied thoroughly by British anthropologist Colin Turnbull, known primarily for his work with the tribe. The remoteness of the Mbuti people has protected them and their environment from the outside world for the most part in pre-1960. Their birth and death rates are high and roughly equal, and as a result, there are no overpopulation problems. Modern advances such as medicine and other technologies have had a rough time reaching them. Although there is no formal constitution or government, the context of their being is in their belief system. They are one with the forest. This factor has helped the Mbuti people escape the non-cyclical problems of other modern and advanced peoples, such as deforestation, overuse of resources, pollution, overpopulation, and the accumulation of toxic wastes, to name just a few difficulties. To conclude the forest people discussion, the forest people of the 1950s who lived in the eastern Congo region evolved to fit in the Ituri forest. They are well equipped with creativity to solve problems. For example, they make tools made of available vegetation, such as nets to capture prey. They also have a strong sense of the self and its relation to the tribe and the forest. They acknowledge their survival depends on belonging to a healthy forest. The forest people also have a much enhanced communication system through verbal and nonverbal languages that allow them the ability to disseminate their relationship to the forest between individuals and generations. There have been records of the forest people in the literature of the ancient Egyptians, so we know their existence spans thousands of years and thus have maintained a healthy balance with their environment. We evolved into hunter-gatherer tribes. You see, nature takes the path of least resistance and effort, which translates into a life of least exertion for the individual. For example, the forest people spend on average 2 hours a day hunting or gathering food, as compared to the 8 hours the civilized spend on a job. In addition, the forest people are physically suited to live in their environment, so whether they are building shelters, preparing food, or singing and dancing into the night, they feel very little, if any, challenges to their way of life. An interesting observation made by Colin was when he took his guide out of the forest in his vehicle, and as they were traveling in an area of flat agricultural fields, a herd of cattle appeared at a far distance from them, and Colin asked his guide to identify them, and the guide responded by saying that they were beetles on the windshield. Can you guess why? Don't let it pass you by that we are naturally built just like the forest people and would adapt easily to the forest or jungle environments. So let's examine each of the building of shelters, gathering and hunting for food, and socializing in more detail. Shelters. A shelter is a temporary structure made of branches, twigs, and leaves gathered from vegetation available around the tribe's campsite. It takes approximately 30 minutes to build. Its purpose is to provide a place to sleep, privacy, and protection from the rain. It is primarily built by the women of the tribe. It is a small structure about the size of a modern bedroom. It is used for approximately 3 or 4 days while they stay at a campsite and is left as is for the forest to absorb once again when they move on to a new camping area. In contrast to the modern shelter, there is no concrete, bricks, wood, copper, plastic, or asphalt put together by the power of crude oil. Food. In a year, each person would require approximately 1 square mile of forest to survive, depending on how productive it is. So a tribe of 20 people would require 20 square miles of territory. This is in contrast to modern human densities of over 100 people per square mile. All hunter-gatherer edibles are found within approximately 30 minutes' reach of the campsite, and all of it is fresh. From fruit to vegetables and meat, all do not require preservatives, refrigeration, or storage. In addition, vehicles and their factories, along with their fuels and oils, are not needed for such short distances. The proximity of these edibles has a positive side effect on the physique of the individual of the tribe, making them fit for their environment. To add further, there is no need for supplements, vitamins, and minerals to the diet simply because it is wholesome. Communication. The forest people have an oral language sufficient to facilitate daily activities and convey ideas and belief systems. No paper was invented, so they have no written form of their language. This is an ideal situation because the environment they live in is constantly changing over time, and so the language can change along with it. If paper was available, the language would have a harder time changing. In other words, the forest people's language is adaptable. Belief system. The forest people believe they are beholden to the forest, which supplies them their livelihood. They call the forest their mother, and if something goes wrong, they believe the forest is not paying attention by not looking after them, so they try to get its attention back on track. This concept indicates that the forest people believe they are part of and not apart from their environment. Their beliefs are played out almost every day through their activities and evenings around the campfire. This is in contrast to modern-day deities that are invisible and often talk of humans being superior to the rest of life on the planet. So, there is no need for the tribe to build monumental cathedrals for the gods because the environment is the place of their worship. There is also no need for the written word to conserve their beliefs because their environment changes from time to time, and an oral belief system is more adaptive to that variation. Socializing. The sense of the tribe and its territory is strong. They do not socialize with other tribes too much, but within their tribe, everybody knows everybody else, and they share all successes and failures. They are also related to each other by blood, and only when the need arises do they bring in new blood into the tribe from other tribes they encounter. The tribe acts as a cohesive and cooperative unit to survive. In their daily activities, whether it is hunting or gathering food, or in the evening around the fire pit, they exchange thoughts and ideas, or play out the story of their collaborative successes. In contrast to modern socialization, the forest people do not need structures like churches, schools, government buildings, sports arenas, or police stations to mingle. They also do not need complicated laws to tell them to cooperate because it is understood the tribe's existence depends on it. In the coming chapters, we will be introducing civilized humans, their cultures, sciences, economies, and their disconnect from nature. The advent of civilization. Outside of the forest people's domain were people who were not as intimately connected to natural earthly deities as the forest people were. These outside people preferred to have deities that were detached from the local environment. The ancient Mesopotamians believed that their deities lived in heaven, but that a god's statue was a physical embodiment of the god himself. As such, cult statues were given constant care and attention, and a set of priests were assigned to tend to them. These priests would clothe the statues and place feasts before them so they could eat. A deity's temple was believed to be that deity's literal place of residence. The gods had boats and full-sized barges, which were normally stored inside their temples, and were used to transport their cult statues along waterways during various religious festivals. The gods also had chariots, which were used for transporting their cult statues by land. Sometimes a deity's cult statue would be transported to the location of a battle so that the deity could watch the battle unfold. The major deities of The Mesopotamian pantheon were believed to participate in the assembly of the gods, through which the gods made all of their decisions. This assembly was seen as a divine counterpart to the semi-democratic legislative system that existed during the Third Dynasty of Ur, c. 2112 BC, c. 2004 BC. Mesopotamia, on the eastern end of the Fertile Crescent, what is now Iraq, was the cradle of Western civilization. It has the distinction of being the very first place on Earth in which the development of agriculture led to the emergence of the essential technologies of civilization. This was followed by civilization's appearance in Egypt. Civilizations also thrived in the Indus Valley by approximately 2500 BC, in China by approximately 1500 BC, and in Central America, what is now Mexico, by approximately 1200 BC. In early civilizations, technology was often focused on agriculture, construction, and transportation. Early humans developed tools such as plows, irrigation systems, carts, and boats to help them farm, build homes and structures, and travel across land and water. Civilization is considered by the civilized as the stage of social and cultural development and organization that is the most advanced. That it is an advanced state of human society in which a high level of culture, science, industry, and government has been achieved. Unfortunately, with the advent of civilization came a parting of ways with nature. On the one hand, was the cyclical nature of the way things worked on Earth, and on the other was the civilized way that used technology to change the course of humanity away from it. The self-preservation motive inherently says that the self is the most important entity in the universe. When translated through the civilized group, it had a far-reaching effect on the psyche of the individual, where they believed they, as part of a cooperative unit, were at the apex of life on Earth, which gave them the right to do whatever they wished to do. Technology amplified the primitive needs of the civilized individual and the group beyond the ability of nature to maintain the balance and diversity of the existing biosphere. For example, the emotion of empathy carried medical supplies to every corner of the globe through the technology of travel and transport, upsetting the local natural birth rate to natural death rate balance that today results in a global civilized population of 8 billion, each clamoring to live. Technology amplifies the expectations, needs, wants, and perceived rights of the individual. God was no longer of the environment, but of the stars, which allowed him to support and play any role in the lives of the civilized. As a result, the civilized invented a monetary system and gave everything a value that was disconnected from the actual natural resource. This value was also an abstract, where they could carry this value without actually carrying whatever it represented with them. For example, they could carry the value of an apple with them from the United States of America to England without actually carrying the apple with them. This disconnected the value of the apple from the apple itself. They also made the apple have any value. For example, they could buy an apple for $1, but if they bought a dozen, they could probably buy them for $10, which makes each apple worth, rapport, 8-3. To a biologist, chemist, or physicist, this makes life and calculations much harder, since they are used to the real ideas of what it took for the apple to come about. It probably took 100,000 calories of sunlight to produce the 300 calories that are in an apple, and this equation does not change at all in nature whether one or a dozen apples are produced. The civilized then created an economy that tries to make resources as low cost as possible by inventing the supply and demand graph or equation that says if a resource becomes scarce, then its cost to the consumer should increase and vice versa. It is said that the increase in the price of a rare resource will allow the producer to expend extra resources to find more of it or a substitute. So the civilized have been busy using their brains to come up with solutions to make their imaginary world fit into the natural one. They claimed that their imaginary world was dynamic and was successful in meeting human needs. The side effect of this imaginary economy was the generation of the need to increase demand through an increase in population so that factories could produce more products to meet the demand and in return generate more capital. As the population grew, the need for more jobs resulted in more factories, which resulted in the need for more people to buy their products. This created a circular, endless growth economy that continues to grow. Unfortunately, in the end, the Earth is the entity that pays for this value liquidity and dynamic economy. This economy assumes the Earth is endless in its ability to provide, that the Earth will deliver enough zinc, for example, and if the civilized can't find zinc, scientists will substitute another earthly mineral or product to fill the gap. There is another effect of this alien capitalistic economy. It has a disastrous effect on the Earth, called the value-added process, because it stratifies the cost of raw materials to end products, where raw materials have a lower value to the economy than the final product. Essentially, a raw material that the Earth still possesses has zero value, and when it is touched by the human hand, it starts to have value, and it increases in value the more human hands get involved in its extraction, transportation, manufacture, and sale. This value-added process is the basis for the indifference of the current economy toward the Earth. This perception has robbed the Earth of most of its free-living flora and fauna, replacing them with the monuments of the civilized. From global ecosystems, the civilized have built massive cities, towns, and hamlets, reducing the ecosystems to farmlands. This perceived progress has taken approximately 90% of the wild spaces, converting them into habitats for the civilized, their farms and pets, and ushering in the sixth mass extinction event on the planet. This value-added and unstable inverted pyramid shows how the value of Earth, at the bottom, is ignorable under the current economy. When we promote this type of economy, we fail to understand that the finite Earth one day will run out of key economic resources. We need to abandon our value-added process and resort to nature's way of looking at all resources as having equal value. So, topple the inverted pyramid and return to the way nature intended us to live. What the politicians who promote this type of economy don't understand is that the Earth one day will run out of zero-value resources. They need to abandon their alien world of dynamic value, endless population growth, and value stratification. The question here is, when will they realize that we need to return to the way nature does things and not continue with these alien systems? To conclude this section on the advent of the civilized have orchestrated cultures, sciences, and economies to fit their needs for growth and domination over all other species and the Earth. They did this by creating an unbalanced world with an insatiable appetite. The introduction of an endless artificial economic growth cycle, where an apple can have any value or cost, leads to the elimination of any standard to the monetary system concerning raw materials, value-added processing, or labor. This leads to the inverted pyramid, which stratified the economies of the civilized. All these transformations caused most, if not all, of our planetary problems, as will be demonstrated shortly. Politics. The civilized have succeeded in creating for themselves a world dependent on global enterprises that have power over them politically, economically, and socially. This power is the result of our disconnect from the natural earthly resources that make our lives comfortable. For example, all you have to do is open your wallet and take out a credit card to pay the cost of $29.95 and have a steak dinner at a nice restaurant. The person eating has no idea or is disconnected from what was involved in making their dinner enjoyable. First, they were disconnected from the animal that had to be killed to provide the steak. In addition, the sauce used in the recipe had milk as an ingredient, which came from a cow that had its calf taken away so that its milk could be diverted to the dinner. Meanwhile, the calf is killed because there is no milk for it, and its meat becomes veal that goes into another disconnected person's dinner. The same train of thought goes a long way in explaining what happens to chickens and their eggs, which are never thought of when eating a chicken salad sandwich. Second, the same goes for the utensils used at that restaurant. In other words, we don't look at the fork and see the gouges in the earth needed to extract the iron ore or the coal that was used to melt the iron. All we see is a fork, and we don't care where it came from. Then there is the house we live in. We never think of the trees that had to fall. We don't care about any of its origin so long as we can buy them. This disconnect is like the saying, the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. The left hand might be doing harmful things, but so long as the right hand does not know that, it does not care. Some forces like to keep the disconnect going. One of them is the stratification of the economic values of the raw materials to the end product. The other is capitalism, whose sole purpose is the accumulation of profits. The oil companies do not care to disclose that they harm the environment where they are drilling for crude oil, since the perceived value of the harm is low and far away. Not until cities started to choke from the engine fumes and indigenous tribes gained a political voice that the oil and automobile companies had to admit that their products were the cause. And instead of trying to find solutions, they insisted they were providing a product and a service based on a free public demand for lower costs. For 100 years or so, this disconnect was going on. It grew from a period where people had to go out into nature, hunt, then kill their food, and make their utensils, to one where you drive up comfortably in a car to a window and then leave with your meal, satisfied, happy, and spreading the word that life is good. But in reality, you are ignorant of the damages made on the other side of the fence on your behalf. So long as the disconnect endures, we will let the status quo continue. Betrayal of reality. The civilized created a belief system that was blind to reality and proceeded to generate an alien reality of their own, simply because they could. Unlike the forest people, they failed to recognize they were a part of this bigger and beautiful world, and not apart from it. The enemy. Nature had become the enemy of the civilized. You see, nature had no preference and treated all the living and non-living equally, as opposed to most civilized belief systems that profess humans are superior. Unlike yesterday, today's religious officials and others seek to retain an emphasis on humans while incorporating environmental concerns within a framework of creation. For example, Christian environmentalists have emphasized the ecological responsibilities of all Christians as stewards of God's earth, that it is a human's responsibility to protect the ecology of the earth. Yet they do not recognize that nature created these ecologies and is well equipped to rectify the situation in its way, and that they, the civilized, need to stand aside from their superior attitude and become humble. They do not recognize that they evolved to live in a cyclical ecology, shoulder to shoulder with all features that are involved, be they lifeless minerals or beaming with life, such as an amoeba. Natural birth and death. The civilized have turned their backs on natural birth and death as part of life and consider it an event to be avoided at all costs. Natural birth and death are a necessary part of life on the planet Earth. There is no escaping it without hardship for millions of species that share this beautiful globe. As the civilized grew in numbers by avoiding natural birth and death, the rest of the biota has pretty much died off. Natural birth and death provide a balance that maintains diversity and sustainability in ecosystems. At present, there is a fly in the ointment, and it is our addiction to human-centric medical and other technologies that are pushing us to the brink of a mass extinction event, according to science. No limits. Despite the reality of our finite Earth, ideas of no limits to what humans are allowed to do sprang out in the vocabulary of the civilized. Our economies depend on this concept of no limits to grow, provide jobs for the working class, and guarantee a livelihood for our politicians. There are no limits to the number of arguments for this flawed concept coming from politicians. And my favorite is, if we run out of X mineral, they will come back and say, technology will find a substitute. Value system. A value system was created where any entity has value if it is touched by the civilized and how many times it was touched. There is another effect of this alien value system. It stratifies the value of raw materials to end products. It stratifies countries according to where they are in the world economy. This value system is the basis for the indifference of the current economy toward the earth. Under this value system, the earth has zero value. This value system is pervasive. It injects itself into the political, social belief systems, and personal affairs arenas. The shortest distance. Instead of allowing life to meander, the civilized have chosen to take the shortcut, and so they base their designs on straight lines or the shortest distance between two points. If a construction engineer finds a large boulder or tree in the path of a road he or she is constructing, he or she will not go around it but destroy it in the process to maintain the straightness of the road. The following chapter will talk about some of the devastation that resulted from the civilized creative processes. The results of civilized activities. The following is a list of side effects from our activities that are grabbed from news headlines. Overpopulation. When Earth is burdened by the efforts to supply a growing population with earthly resources, it ceases to become sustainable. It can only be sustainable when human birth rates are equal to death rates, which they are not in the case of the civilized, where birth rates are higher than that of death. Another factor related to population is the consumption rate of resources per individual. The consumption rate must be to equal or less than the growth or natural regenerative rate. For example, the hunter-gatherer tribes of the Amazon River Basin keep moving from place to place to allow this regenerative process to take place and replenish the resources consumed. This is in contrast to the sedentary way the civilized are living that does not allow for the natural replenishment of Earth's resources. A third factor is the size of the population. The current 8 billion population size is unsustainable because it aggravates the balance of birth-to-death rates and the consumption levels expected for the civilized. It will be shown in a later chapter that the sustainable population level is 1,000 times less than the current level. Fossil fuels. In addition to the mental anguish we have brought upon ourselves through the use of technology, current evidence indicates that we, the civilized, are returning climate conditions to their levels 60 million years ago, when global temperatures were higher with different atmospheric chemistry. There is no question as to whether civilized activities are driving this process by exhuming ancient fossil fuels. It is as if nature is pulling the civilized by the nose to show us the extent to which our current activities are unsustainable and need to be changed. Illness. As mentioned in the introduction, we are the result of nature. To deny this leads to many examples of illnesses of the physical and the mind. The loss of habitats. With the domestication of a limited taxonomy of plants and animals favored by the civilized, more and more lands are required to support them, which results in a loss of habitat for the rest of the plant and animal species of no interest to the civilized. For example, in the northwest United States of America, beef cattle are raised on ranges where they compete with other indigenous species that naturally inhabit those areas. This competition is further weighted against the wild species by the civilized population's tendency to hunt, kill by shooting, or poison those undesirable species. For example, the puma has been reduced in numbers by shooting and killing to protect the cattle grazing in their habitats. Another example is that of the wolves, who are perceived as killing livestock and therefore are killed, poisoned, or burned in their dens. Predator elimination. Predator killing is a case of one predator killing off another to take their food. It come under the guise of wildlife management. Here in the NW of the USA, they have killed off most cougars so that sports hunters will have plenty of deer or elk to kill. Soil erosion and degradation. Natural processes moved rocks from their resting places down hills and gullies through the power of wind and water currents, causing them to collide with each other. All these movements and collisions resulted in the formation of soils some 450 million years ago, when plants started to take root after evolving from much simpler organisms. Since then, soils have moved and developed through the very same processes. In general, stable soil is one where the soil is removed from an area at roughly the same rate as the soil is deposited. A much more recent problem is the loss of soils at a much faster rate than their deposition. This is the result of civilized human action, such as overgrazing, where the soil is exposed to elements such as strong winds and floods from a lack of cover, or inappropriate cultivation practices such as plowing. These actions leave the land vulnerable and unprotected. Soil may also be degraded by salination from the application of chemicals such as pesticides and fertilizers, nutrient loss from runoff from floods, and compression due to other civilized activities such as agriculture and construction. The result of soil erosion and degradation is a reduction in soil fertility and its support of living plants and animals, including the human species. Deforestation. It has been estimated that approximately half of Earth's mature tropical forests, dear Earth, between 2.9 to 3 million square miles of the original 5.8 to 6.2 million square miles that until 1947 covered the planet have now been destroyed. Some scientists have predicted that unless significant measures are taken, such as seeking out and protecting old-growth forests around the world before 2030, there will only be 10% remaining, with another 10% in a degraded condition. 80% will have been lost, and with them millions of irreplaceable animal, plant, and insect species. These losses are due to logging, fossil fuel activities such as exploration and drilling, mining which carves out huge gouges in the Earth's mantle, and farming where the old growths are down to plant crops and graze animals. Insecticides. Throughout most of human history, insects have been loathed, from locusts that devour whole plantations to termites that feed on the structural wood of houses, and the weevil that is a pest of many crops, such as cotton. They have gained a reputation as being detrimental to the interests of the civilized. To reduce the effects of these pests, insecticides and pesticides were developed to kill these pests. These chemicals are sprayed over the affected crops by hand or airplane. There are two problems with these applications. The first is the wind may carry the insecticide to other unintended fields, and the second is that they are most often not discriminant of the type of insect killed. For example, some insects were discovered to be rather essential. The bee is just one example. It wasn't until its beneficial effects on pollination were discovered that an appreciation of its services to the civilized began to be recognized. Today, bees are in grave danger from the insecticides used by the civilized to protect plants from other insects and fungi. Honeybees are critical for pollinating food crops. Scientists say the disruption of pollination could dramatically affect entire ecosystems. Yet, many more insects and insect larvae are critical to human existence. The depletion of global fisheries, a report entitled Status and Solutions for the World's Unassessed Fisheries by the Sustainable Fisheries Group, SFG, has confirmed suspicions held by many researchers that nearly 80% of the world's fisheries are in steep decline. The reasons for these declines are overfishing caused by a multitude of factors, including but not limited to an unmanaged common, where oceans outside the territories of a country are considered fair game to anyone, and technologies that improve detection and capture of marine wildlife with such indiscriminate methods as gigantic nets that scoured the oceans for any species to feed those masses of 8 billion people. 90% of ocean fish monitored by the United Nations are fully exploited, overexploited, or depleted. We need to put limits on what and how much we catch. All fish species deserve a safe habitat and ability to survive. Invasive species and the balance of nature. What makes a species invasive? An invasive species can be any kind of living organism, an amphibian, like the cane toad, plant, insect, fish, fungus, bacteria, or even an organism's seeds or eggs, that is not native to an ecosystem and causes harm. They can harm the environment, the economy, or even human health. Species that grow and reproduce quickly and spread aggressively with the potential to cause harm are given the label invasive. Invasive species are species that are transferred from one ecosystem to another, where they compete with native ones and take over their habitats. An increase in global trade has led to a further increase in the number of plant and animal species that are carried from one part of the globe to another, legally, illegally, or accidentally. Some of these species become pests and wreak havoc on their destination ecosystems, such as rabbits and mice in Australia and blackberries in the Americas, often reducing biodiversity and threatening ecological balance. For example, native to the Indo-Pacific Oceanic region, lionfish are quickly spreading throughout the coasts and coral reefs of the United States East Coast. Lionfish are voracious eaters, and their venomous dorsal spines have helped to protect them so far from any natural predation in the Atlantic. Another example is the Japanese beetles, which are an invasive species in North America. They are native to the islands of Japan, where their population is naturally controlled by predators such as wasps. These wasps do not exist in North America, and Japanese beetles have become a major pest to farmers growing crops such as grapes. Energy. Other energy sources such as solar, geothermal, biomass, nuclear, wind, wave energy, or other renewables are not the solution. They only give us another way to gouge the ground for minerals, destroy more forests, and obliterate the habitats of other species. We need a lifestyle that consumes much less energy so that we do not affect Earth's ecologies and biota that we very much depend on. Hazardous and toxic waste. Hazardous waste is waste that poses a substantial threat to public health and the environment. Worldwide, the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, estimated that more than 400 million tons of hazardous waste are produced each year by industrialized countries, with about 4 million tons shipped across international boundaries. Most of these transfers occur between industrialized countries and developing nations, where they are disposed of due to the rising cost of disposing of hazardous waste in the home country. Disposal consists of storage either above or below ground, leaving a legacy for future generations. In the case of biological toxins, they are often incinerated or simply released into the air. Examples of hazardous waste include lead paint that was used in houses before 1968, obsolete computers, their components, and batteries. These types of wastes cannot be thrown into the garbage, for they will contaminate the surrounding soils and groundwater, causing great harm to people and the environment. Capitalism. Capitalism isn't freedom. Its premise is the accumulation of wealth through increased profit. To increase profit, it must cut down trees, gouge the earth, acquire other species' habitats, and pollute the land, sky, and water. Capitalism is serving us, the civilized consumers. There are two problems with this statement. First, capitalist companies are after efficient profitability, where, among other behaviors, cruelty is an acceptable tool. Second, civilized populations are encouraged to grow, consume, and waste more to feed the profit mills. We need to abolish capitalism for the sake of restoring our humanity. Water depletion. Groundwater is a valuable resource throughout the world. Where surface water, such as lakes and rivers, is scarce or inaccessible, groundwater supplies the needs of the civilized. Sustained groundwater pumping, because of overpopulation, causes groundwater depletion and is a key issue distressing groundwater use. Pumping lowers the water table, requiring drilling to greater depths, which in turn makes pumping more expensive. Many areas of the world are experiencing groundwater depletion. Rainfall and snowfall not only replenish groundwater supplies, but also provide year-round water sources for many communities by replenishing snow to mountains in the winter, which in turn provides water in the summer. However, our increasing usage of this rainwater due to water shortages proves a further problem. In addition, the reduction of water in streams and lakes is partly due to groundwater depletion, reduction of the water table, and climate change. Landslides also occur when water is removed from the soil. In addition, the soil collapses and compacts when water is removed or not replenished. The deterioration in the quality of fresh groundwater supplies is caused by saltwater intrusion from oceans, seas, deeper groundwater sources, and the water below the oceans, which are all saline. If we consider that one hamburger takes about 635 gallons of fresh water to produce, the problem becomes clear. To look at water consumption on a different level, the average American household uses 107,000 gallons per day, 2012. For example, it takes 672 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of cheese. Global warming. Today we are witnessing the very early stages of global warming and its effects, but there are signs we are on the road to more significant changes in weather and ocean patterns. There are many agricultural communities dependent on the annual melting of glacier ice and its subsequent replenishment. In addition, the ocean and sea levels have been rising at the rate of an inch every 10 years and are now accelerating. In the United States of America, forest fires are burning larger sections of land and are reaching higher up the mountains where there was once snow to slow them down. These fires are also burning at hotter temperatures, and trees such as the ponderosa pines, whose seeds germinate when there is a fire, are now dying of the extreme heat these new fires generate. Nitrous oxides. Methane and carbon dioxide play an important role in atmospheric chemistry. They are emitted into the atmosphere. Naturally, mainly because of microbial activities in soils and lightning discharges. Today, emissions predominantly occur because of civilized activities, such as the combustion of fossil fuels, biomass burning, and the use of fertilizers. For example, long-term trends of nitrous oxide concentration in the atmosphere are not documented adequately. Nevertheless, reconstructed emission inventories suggest that large increases have occurred throughout this century. Exposure to nitrous oxides has direct adverse effects on humans, animals, and plants. Nitrous oxides also contribute to the global environmental problems facing our planet, i.e., excessive global warming, depletion of the ozone layer, and acid rain. The following is a chart showing the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Extinctions. We are living through a biodiversity crisis. The fastest extinction rate in Earth's history is happening right now, largely due to the actions of the civilized. According to the calculation methods of Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson, 700,000 species have become extinct since 1976, largely due to the loss of part or all of their habitats. This biodiversity crisis has been snowballing for the last 100 years, and many experts predict a sixth mass extinction is on the way. Many species have become extinct because of hunting and overharvesting, the conversion of wetlands and forests to croplands and urban areas, pollution, the introduction of invasive species, and other forms of human-caused destruction of their natural environments. Indeed, current rates of human-induced extinctions are estimated to be about 1,000 times greater than past natural background rates of extinction, leading some scientists to call modern times the sixth mass extinction. The prospect of mass extinction. Elizabeth Colbert is an American journalist, author, and visiting fellow at Williams College. She is best known for her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction: An Unnatural History. She is an observer and commentator on the environment for The New Yorker magazine. She argues that our species today is rapidly changing the shape of the Earth and the composition of the atmosphere, in the process unleashing a mass extinction of most living things, quite possibly including ourselves. Previous major extinctions, /en/wikipedia.org/wiki/extinction-event. There are several examples of what are known as major extinctions in which a large group of species simply end up dead when their habitats no longer exist or are unable to support them. It is true we don't know the cause of many of these events, but their speed and magnitude resemble so closely the blooms in a pond that we just have to at least mention them here. In the past 540 million years, it is estimated that there have been five major extinctions when over 50% of animal species died. The following is a list of those extinctions. 1. Cretaceous-Paleogene mass extinction, 66 million years ago. About 75% of all species became extinct. In the seas, it reduced the percentage of sessile animals to about 33%. All non-avian dinosaurs became extinct during that time. 2. Triassic-Jurassic mass extinction 200 million years ago. About 70% to 75% of all species became extinct. 3. Permian-Triassic mass extinction 251 million years ago. Earth's largest extinction killed 90% to 96% of all species. 4. Late Devonian mass extinction 375 to 360 million years ago. About 70% of all species became extinct. This extinction event lasted perhaps as long as 20 million years, and there is evidence of a series of extinction pulses within this period. Number 5. Ordovician-Silurian mass extinction, 405 to 440 million years ago. Two events occurred that killed 60% to 70% of all species. The point I am trying to make is that major extinctions do happen, and at present, our only tool to predict that it is happening right now is science. Problems with green energy. The following chart shows the current production of greenhouse gases and other toxins in the USA. Please note that the transportation sector, which consists of approximately 300 million vehicles, is producing 1,476 million tons of GHG and little, if any, toxins per year. Given that the current number of electric vehicles is 3 million, if we want to convert all other vehicles to electric by the year 2030 using solar energy, it would involve the reduction of GHGs to 396 million tons and an increase of 35 million tons of toxins per year. Toxins produced by the solar energy sector of the economy: cadmium telluride, copper, indium selenide, cadmium gallium, diselenide, hexafluoroethane, lead, silicon tetrachloride, polyvinyl fluoride. Problems with recycling: Sustainability is a broad concept referring to the ability to maintain or sustain something over time without causing harm or depleting resources. Generally, it applies to various domains, including the environment, economy, and society. Recycling is one facet of sustainability. However, current methods of recycling are coming up short. 1. Paper recycling. Human recycling is pseudo-recycling compared to nature's recycling. The chemicals we use to recycle used paper to usable paper pollute our rivers, streams, and in general our environments with such a chemical as dioxin that causes cancer. 2. Only 12.5% of electronic waste is recycled. 85% of our electronic waste is sent to landfills and incinerators where they are burned, releasing harmful toxins in the air. Electronic waste contains multiple known and suspected neurotoxicants, including lead and mercury, that may disrupt the development of the central nervous system during pregnancy, infancy, childhood, and adolescence. Some harmful toxicants from e-waste may also impact the structural development and function of the lungs. 3. In the United States, which is by far the world's biggest plastics polluter, only around 5% of over 50 million tons of plastic waste produced by households in 2021 was recycled, according to Greenpeace. With plastic production set to triple globally by 2060, plastics made primarily from oil or gas are a growing source of carbon pollution fueling climate change. Much is also ending up in oceans and severely impacting marine life. Even if we make a dent in the recycling of plastic, it will require energy, and most likely from solar or wind sources that have their own toxic side products. Generally speaking, the processes of human recycling to achieve sustainability also produce side effects such as toxins and pollution that harm society, the environment, and the economy. For example, 1. Toxins will harm both the environment and society. They will also cost money that has to come from the economy. 2. Pollution will harm the environment and society and drain the economy of resources to fix. In summary of recycling, human recycling efforts by science and technology fail to guarantee the safety of the civilized and the environment for wild plants and animals. This throws doubt on the success of sustainability efforts. To conclude, the civilized activities expose. There is no doubt, the civilized are the ultimate invasive species that are the direct cause of this mental anguish, habitat loss, and the extinction of species. They did it through such events as overpopulation, the transformation of the landscape, through agriculture, construction, and forestry practices, pollution, global warming, and the introduction of alien species into existing ecosystems. In other words, the self-proclaimed ideal species of the planet has run amok, perhaps because of the mental stresses it brought upon itself. Presently, it looks like the world's economic locomotive is running at full juggernaut speed and unable to stop. It is so because a democratic consensus to slam on the brakes will invalidate the whole economic system the population has grown dependent on for so long and will result in extreme hardship. In conclusion, there is no hope of stopping the locomotive in time, and it will drive itself off of the cliff of extinction and take approximately 50% of Earth's life with it. Section 3. Can humans survive? The civilized population bloom. The human population has exploded from a few tribes in Africa 300,000 years ago to a global population of 8 billion today, predominantly due to our civilized activities. It is hard to believe that today, 96% of the biomass of mammals on Earth consists of humans, their pets, and farm animals. If the ultimate achievement of a species is to increase its numbers, we might ask at this point, are there any negative side effects to the apparent success of the civilized? The term bloom refers to the explosion of algae density in a pond. It'll be used here to explain what could happen to the human population. To understand what an algae bloom does, we first must understand how a pond of water operates. A pond, naturally occurring in the forest, consists of a pond bottom made out of soil or clay that is a depression in the ground filled with water. On top of the water is air. Algae grow in water, it receives sunlight from above, nutrients from the water, and the soil beneath. As the algae grow, matures, and dies, it sinks to the bottom of the pond. There, bacteria decompose the algae matter and release key elements that then circulate in the pond water, nourishing subsequent generations of algae. Algae blooms in ponds are common. They occur when the conditions are right for algae to take a sudden or prolonged burst of growth. This burst is usually due to an increase in one or more chemical resources in the water essential for algae growth, such as compounds containing phosphate. Most blooms are benign to the water system. The water might turn a bright green color for a few days or a week or so. The algae that blooms die and sink to the bottom of the pond when the chemicals that initiated the bloom are consumed. Some water systems experience long blooms. These may last from a month to two or longer, so long as the chemical resources responsible for the bloom continue to come into the water system, such as effluent from sewer systems. This can be devastating to the water system's biota and cycles, because the increase in the number of algae corpses being consumed by bacteria, which is an oxygen consumer, will cause the lake to become oxygen deficient for many plants and animal species, which in turn die off. This type of bloom chokes the life out of the lake that will eventually die, culminating in an aerobic bacterium jumping into action, producing foul smells like rotten eggs associated with stagnant water systems, after most, if not all, oxygen is consumed. You would think that even if the chemical sources that promoted the bloom in the first place continue to flow into the pond, the bloom will continue indefinitely. But on the contrary, the bloom will eventually die off and sink to the bottom of the water system if other chemical resources necessary for life are depleted as a result of the bloom. You see, algae depend on many chemical resources present in the water system, and when one or more of these are depleted, the bloom can't continue and dies off, sinking to the bottom, where the bacteria go to work. To bring back a pond that has experienced a bloom, we need to take out the algae, plant matter, and animals that had died during the boom and their associated decomposition bacteria. In addition, all sources of chemicals responsible for the bloom must be stopped from entering the pond. Only then will enough oxygen be reabsorbed by the pond from the air above, allowing fish, plants, and algae to grow once again and continue the life cycle of the pond. You could ask, how does the talk of pond blooms relate to this book? It is the contention of this philosophy as it relates to mankind. We are undergoing a bloom. The current civilizations are highly dependent on fossil fuels that drive the consumption of other resources that are not limitless on this finite earth. The signs are all around us, which includes the destruction of the habitats of countless species that we depend on for our habitat sustenance. Underlying this argument is the idea that we as humans and our habitat are no different than the algae in the pond. It is all a matter of chemical reactions that follow physical laws of which we have no control. Whether it is phosphates or fossil fuels that cause the long bloom, the results are similar. In these modern times, we face a whole new set of challenges that differ from the challenges faced by our Greek ancestors, such as Socrates and Plato. In those early times, the challenges were those of aggregating people together into cities that were under the control of fair and acceptable laws. Today we face a whole new set of problems related to the biological success of our species. A bloom is a common growth trend, and humans are simply following the programs coded into their genetics and language information systems down a similar path. In the pond example, all life was extinguished except for the bacteria consuming the dead material left behind, and in the mass extinction examples, total loss of life on Earth was 50% or more. Will the effects of the human bloom be the same, more or less, than that of the long algae blooms and mass extinctions? Will human activities cause or deter the next mass extinction? A 2014 study in the journal Science, published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, found that species of plants and animals are becoming extinct at least 1,000 times faster than they did before humans appeared 200,000 years ago. Human impacts on the quantity and variation in biosphere species are not well understood by the general public. Among vertebrates that walk on land, 322 species have become extinct since 1500 AD, and populations of the remaining species show a 25% decline in abundance. Doyle Rice, USA Today, 6:32 p.m. EDT, July 24, 2014. What's new about this extinction is that the driving force is not a meteorite or a megavolcanic eruption, but one species, Homo sapiens, and specifically the civilized. The loss and decline of animals around the world are caused by habitat loss due to human population growth, expansion, and competition, invasions by other non-native species, and global climate disruptions due to greenhouse gases. On the other hand, there are scientific and non-scientific predictions that the human population will experience a drastic decline in the coming 20 to 50 years. One such study is detailed in the book entitled Limits to Growth, Meadows, Danella et al., in which the population of humans will drop by 50% or more in the next 30 years or so, along with a tenfold decline in the Human Welfare Index compared to today. Whether this or another predictor of human decline comes about, will it be enough to save the planet Earth from the next mass extinction? Of course, to be scientific, we need to measure and quantify these human side effects. The factor of temperature. Current evidence indicates we are on the cusp of a global biosphere change, possibly returning climate conditions to what existed 55 to 60 million years ago, where global temperatures were higher, as well as having a different atmospheric chemistry. There is no question human activity is driving this sad event by exhuming ancient remains and resurrecting the conditions in existence back then. It is as if nature is saying, the current climate conditions are not sustainable, and Earth needs to reset and return to a previously maintainable environment or state. Presently, let's leave the scientists to explain how they found out what the climate was like back then, and introduce Joop van Dijk, who published in the ETH Zurich, and Peter Ruge, who published in the hduw.futurity.org/website on December 2, 2020, credit Sonar/Flickr. Between 55 and 57 million years ago, the geological epoch known as the Paleocene ended and gave way to the Eocene. At that time, the atmosphere was essentially flooded by the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide, with concentration levels reaching 1,400 ppm to 4,000 ppm. So it's not hard to imagine that temperatures on Earth must have resembled those of a sauna. It was hot and humid, and the ice on the polar caps had completely disappeared. The Earth's climate in that era provides researchers with an indication as to how today's climate might develop. While pre-industrial levels of atmospheric CO2 stood at 280 ppm, today's measure 412 ppm. Climate scientists believe that CO2 emissions generated by human activity could drive this figure up to 1,000 ppm by the end of the century. Using tiny siderite minerals in soil samples taken from former swamps, researchers reconstructed the climate that prevailed at the end of the Paleocene and in the early Eocene. Ancient Earth's temperature. The siderite minerals formed in an oxygen-free soil environment that developed under dense vegetation in swamps, which were abundant along the hot and humid coastlines in the Paleocene and Eocene. To reconstruct the climatic conditions from the equator to the polar regions, the researchers studied siderites from 13 different sites. These were all located in the northern hemisphere, covering all geographical latitudes from the tropics to the Arctic. Our reconstruction of the climate based on the siderite samples shows that a hot atmosphere also comes with high levels of moisture, says lead author Joop van Dijk, who completed his doctorate in ETH Zurich, Professor Stefano Bernasconi's group at the Geological Institute. Accordingly, between 57 and 55 million years ago, the mean annual air temperature at the equator where Colombia lies today was around 41 degrees centigrade, 105.8 degrees Fahrenheit. In Arctic Siberia, the average summer temperature was 23 degrees Celsius centigrade, 73.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Using their siderite hygrometer, the researchers also demonstrated that the global moisture content in the atmosphere, or the specific humidity, was much higher in the Paleocene and Eocene eras than it is today. In addition, water vapor remained in the air for longer because specific humidity increased at a greater rate than evaporation and precipitation. However, the increase in specific humidity was not the same everywhere. Since they had access to siderite from all latitudes, the researchers were also able to study the spatial pattern of the specific humidity. They found that the tropics and higher latitudes would have had very high humidity levels. The researchers attribute this phenomenon to water vapor that was transported to these zones from the subtropics. Specific humidity rose the least in the subtropics. While evaporation increased, precipitation decreased. This resulted in a higher level of atmospheric water vapor, which ultimately reached the poles and the equator, and the atmospheric vapor carried heat along with it. Climate scientists still observe the flow of water vapor and heat from the subtropics to the tropics today. Latent heat transport was likely to have been even greater during the Eocene, Van Dyke says. And the increase in the transport of heat to high latitudes may well have been conducive to the intensification of warming in the polar regions, he adds, from past to future. These new findings suggest that today's global warming goes hand in hand with increased transport of moisture and, by extension, heat in the atmosphere. Atmospheric moisture transport is a key process that reinforces warming of the polar regions, Van Dyke explains. Although the CO2 content in the atmosphere was much higher back then than it is today, the increase in these values took place over millions of years, he points out. Things are different today. Since industrialization began, humans have raised the level of atmospheric CO2 by almost 50% over just 170 years, he says. In the past, animals and plants had much more time to adapt to the changing climatic conditions. They simply can't keep up with today's rapid development, Van Dyke says. Finding the siderites was not easy. For one thing, the minerals are tiny, plus they occur solely in fossil swamps, which today are often found only several kilometers, 1 kilometer is 0.6 miles below the Earth's surface. This made it difficult or even impossible for the researchers to dig up siderites themselves. We made several expeditions to sites where we believed siderites might occur, but we found them at only one of those locations, Van Dyke says. Fortunately, study co-author Tim White of Penn State owns the world's largest collection of siderites. The research appears in Nature Geoscience. Additional researchers from CASP in Cambridge contributed to the work. Related to climate change are other issues discussed previously, such as the burning of forests that release more CO2 into the air, the melting of snow caps on mountains that are the source of water for many species' activities, the melting of the polar ice sheets, and the acidification of the oceans and lakes. Of course, climate change is not the only problem life on Earth is facing. There is the pollution of the soil, water, and air, with the various chemicals that our industries produce, the most sinister of which are the forever chemicals that endanger all the living on the planet. So, the problem we are facing is multifaceted. If we can solve one harmful facet of the problem, others will not let us alone but will attack. Unfortunately, we are presently trying to solve one problem at a time. This will not work, and so the future of the planet is bleak. It is so because if we run out of minerals to continue maintaining our industrial, service, and agricultural economies while battling climate change, we are doomed. If we run out of water while battling the shortage of minerals, we are doomed. If we kill off the last bee while battling the shortage of water, we are doomed. If we run out of healthy air to breathe while saving bees, we will choke to death. And if we overuse our soils and degrade them while trying to save our air, we will starve to death. Section 4, The Confession. There are no two ways about it. The civilized descended upon the earth like locusts on a cornfield, devouring everything in sight and laying waste to the land, water, and air. And now they talk of going to other planets to do the same. There is only one phrase for such a culture. It is an invasive alien parasite. Apology. The Amazon is burning because we are not good stewards of the land. The seas and oceans are becoming depleted of life because we are not good stewards of the waters. The air we breathe is becoming polluted because we are not good stewards of the atmosphere. We were never meant to be stewards of anything, but instead to be managed by nature. In addition, there is one thing we must realize here, and that is, nature makes no promises. There are many examples of evolutionary dead ends in which a species or a cluster of species simply die off when their habitats no longer exist or are unable to support them. So where do I start? Where should I begin? The issue is so vast. But Earth's pain compels me to write and to try to find an explanation. I am not to blame, and yet I am responsible. I have departed from Earth's natural path and find myself with my head in the clouds, unable to see the reckless approaches in my advances treading on Earth's hallowed grounds in ignorance. I now must confess and take accountability for my actions and the actions of those who preceded me in my civilized family, for we have created this great burden Earth now carries. I have peeked through the fog and I have seen a light that is bright and hard. Yet it has taken hundreds of years to get to where we have gotten, and I have but a few years left in my life to help some of the civilized to at least give this light a second glance. So, I lower my brow and look to my feet and to the ground I am standing on, for that is the focus of my salvation. Then, I look up at the sky and observe the sun, for there is the essence that could have led us to the way intended for us. The earth and the sun were the yin and yang of that which is sacred to life. I hear earth's screams clearly, and I am ashamed, but yet I cannot help it. I have gotten used to my lifestyle now, and even if I decide to follow the path of recovery, there is nowhere to start. For I and the civilized have done away with Earth's conventions and transformed the Earth into an alien landscape. There is nowhere to go physically to start the journey that leads to nature. Oh, how I wish I had started my journey long, long ago. So here I am, writing and hoping at least one of the civilized will read of the natural Earth and somehow understand my message, lowering their heads below the clouds to breathe some fresh air and see the simple truth. It was not about wealth, power, or technology. It was about the wisdom of nature and how it balances the earth and the sun in the dance of life. It should have all come naturally, but civilization's foreign ways distorted man's vision away from this reality. I dream of the day that enough of the civilized start to see the truth of nature's way and help in restoring dignity to the earth and our lives, so that we are with nature once again. Oh, how I lament my outlandish ways. I imagine they will slowly turn their minds to nature, and then perhaps will come to a final and very physical appreciation of the marvel that is Earth. How I wish that reality would sink in, that they would become conscious more and more of what has been lost. It is not a matter of positively thinking of nature. That is not enough. What is needed is to be able to stand naked in a forest and consider it home. You see, when I actively think of nature, I detract from nature's gift. For I am nature, in and out. I belong to nature, and not the other way around. I should not have built monuments, for nature was the builder. I should not have provided anything such as agriculture, for nature was always the provider. All we needed was earth and the vibrantly bright sun to make happiness available to all. Why should we have aimed at the heavenly stars when heaven was here in earth's arms? Why should we have sought wealth when all was given freely? Why should we have pursued power that created the powerless from our brothers and sisters? Why should we have pursued technology for it only kept our heads dreaming of the impossible? Who gave the civilized the right to dump waste in the oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers? From garbage to sewage and forever chemicals, we have been polluting Earth's waterways beyond their ability to process our waste, thinking these waterways to be ours to poison as we saw fit. Who gave the civilized the right to fish Earth's oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers, as if the fish were ours to take at any cost? Who gave the civilized the right to suck up all Earth's rivers and groundwaters that other species depend upon, as if these waters were ours to do with as we pleased? Who gave the civilized the right to pollute the air and change the climate? Who gave the civilized the right to tear down Earth's forest lands for its timber, scarring Earth's beautiful face with roads and bridges? Who gave the civilized the right to gouge deep holes in Earth's precious complexion to accommodate our hunger for minerals? In actuality, no one has given the civilized those rights, but instead we have proclaimed them as a right through which to pursue happiness. Our brains perceived a mirage in which we were more valuable than any other of Earth's beings. If it came to a choice between nature or the life of a civilized person, the well-being of that person would somehow be considered first. It is not enough to plant a vegetable garden and call it organic just to demonstrate positive thinking towards nature. It is not enough to abstain from using chemicals to grow vegetables. It is not enough to turn away from the use of motorized implements to plow the fields. Nor is it enough to grow the vegetable garden with sustainable means such as composting for soil conditioning and fertilization, plant rotation to avoid soil mineral depletion, or drip irrigation to conserve water. All of these practices ultimately involve imperfect inventions. The idea of the civilized growing plants was an alien inkling. At best, we should have let it wither away from our minds. Plants grow on their own in the places where they are best suited. Humans do not need to do anything for plants to naturally flourish. Nature is the provider of all that is good and healthy for the living. For nature is 4 billion years wiser than any of us arrogant representatives of civilization. Sure, nature has tried and failed, but it then tried again until it got beautiful. No amount of civilized ingenuity or technology will ever replace the astute methods of nature, because nature will always be billions of steps ahead of us. We should have given up our egotistical ways long ago and submitted to nature's authority. For humility is the only way to think positively about Earth. We should be wise and consider ourselves part and not apart from Earth's living cycles, the web of life, and its ecosystems. Notions that humans are at the top of the food chain and humans have a superior intelligence are wrong. We are but a link, no better or worse than any other in the chain of life, be it a clump of mud or another species in Earth's organization. The interference of our intellect and that of the civilized has fed our egos, leading us astray and blinding us to their consequences. The more we took, the less was left for others whom we depend upon. Will we ever realize that and tear down the upside-down value-added pyramid and return to nature again and consider all things having equal value? There are two ways of turning back. One is to forgo the notions of superiority, perform some kind of lobotomy, and kill these inappropriate opportunistic impulses. The other is to engage in the pursuit of Earth's salvation through a more respectful lifestyle akin to that of the lion and the gazelle. This mature lifestyle has been alive for many millennia in the human species. Numerous indigenous tribes practiced it and considered themselves part of their environment. For example, the Mbuti people live in the Ituri forest. To reiterate, the forest is the center of Mbuti life. They consider the forest to be their great protector and provider and believe that it is a sacred place. To conclude the apology discussion, now that the damage has been done and the point of no return from extinction is fast approaching, what can we say but regret listening to our inner voices that said, "Take whatever you want"? How could we have been so blind as to reject all of those examples around us of the way that other species or people have managed their abodes? I am sorry for what we have done to Earth by defiling the waterways, laying waste to the landscapes, and making the air the repository of toxins. I am sorry for my arrogant attitude. I am sorry present and preceding generations of the civilized nurtured and took care of their own at the expense of Earth's dignity. It seems such a sure sign of success for a short period, but not indeed for long. And now, the civilized and the rest of Earth's creation stand at the very door of the void. Section 5. What is it that defines the civilized? Is it culture? Is it technology? Is it power? The written word, the human limits. We might ask why the civilized embarked on this path of creating a reality of their own, challenging that of nature. After all, they are natural beings acting naturally, and we would think they would stick to true and tested natural methods. The author has come to understand the human brain and its two most basic limitations. The first being a physical limitation in the quantity and quality of information it can store. The second is a result of the limitations of its sensory organs in perceiving reality. In simple terms, nature is infinite while humans are finite. Therefore, humans will never be able to understand nature and how things work in the universe, let alone how the Earth works. Although our brain's memory is limited in information, the brain can manipulate information and even create it. This is perhaps best demonstrated in how we solve problems, for example, by bringing together two different memories and producing a third that may solve some need. Unfortunately, since memories are limited in information and the process of linking two memories follows no known law, the result is an abstract and creative solution that will not necessarily prove to work in the real world. We must now realize that the structures of the brain and those of reality are quite different. To help us visualize this, let us imagine that an understanding of the creative world generated by the human brain comes in the form of a stack of square blocks, with natural counterparts coming in the form of balls. we might well envision the blocks of our imagining to tumble and fall if built on reality. When building a square structure on a round reality, it immediately becomes unstable. According to such an example, most of what humans can conceive of or build will be out of balance with the natural world and fail. We should rather try our best to follow nature, which inevitably proves more durable than anything we could have created. In whatever we do, we should let nature set the path, because nature is the final authority on what is right and suitable. As you may recall, positive changes to DNA through mutations rarely occur and are selected by how it makes the individual fit or function in their environment. The selection process weighs the benefit against possible detriment to the individual. Given the wisdom of nature, how did the challenged humans fly under the selection radar screening process undetected? How did their creativity cause such a calamity? If there is one product of human brain creativity that is to blame, it is the written word in all its forms, be it on stone, paper, or computer. What is meant by the written word is the transfer of the mental creative product outside the individual for others to experience, understand, and use, such as technology. Since human memory contains an abstract creative solution that will not necessarily prove to work in the real world, the recording of this information for others to take in will only result in a product that is even less functional. In addition, there are information filters of different colors or persuasions in each individual and culture that skew the meaning of the information presented. So, cattle look like beetles on a windshield, or the victims of wrongdoing are perceived as the bad guys, and vice versa. No wonder the earth is in such a mess. The egocentric creativity of the human brain is not able to comprehend the complexity of nature's ways and passes its flawed creative technological products on to the next generation through the written word, regardless of its detrimental effects on other species or the environment, such as ecosystem balances. And the story does not end there. Detrimental DNA mutations take one individual and one lifetime to be tested by natural selection and eliminated. But the written word can be spread 100 or 1,000 times and even evolve in a matter of a few short days, hours, or seconds. By doing so in its paper or computer format, it escapes the natural selection test process until manifestation in a form that natural selection can act on. We might ask ourselves why nature has not weeded these flawed ideas and products when they manifest themselves. For example, if a house designed on paper is built out of wood from a few trees, the detrimental impact to the forest they came from is probably small. But when 1,000 such houses are built out of wood from the same forest, the impact is 1,000 times greater and may cause the forest to perish along with all the flora and fauna that depend on it. This can and does occur 100 or 1,000 times within a generation of humans, and too late for natural selection to act on the humans who created and promoted the house design. In addition, the design itself cannot be acted upon functionally by natural selection, since it is not in the form of the final product. In other words, the spread of the written word and its manifestations are faster than nature can act to stop them. Section 6. Time for a decision. This decision is not one where we choose what color of socks to wear, but one that is a landslide, an avalanche, an earthquake that shakes the basic foundation of all we have been brought up to believe as civilized human beings. To do or not to do, we have departed from Earth's natural path of sustainability and found ourselves with our heads in the clouds, drunk with power, unable to see the reckless approaches in our advances and treading on Earth's hallowed grounds in ignorance. The rising human population count has a huge impact on water, wildlife, forests, oceans, rivers, soils, atmosphere, migratory paths, and just about every ecological factor you can think of. It is therefore imperative we allow nature to return the resilient balance between all species. It is true that governments and people are waking up to the facts and are attempting to find solutions affecting our future. We have three alternatives in front of us. We either let nature take its course the way things are today, we come up with a solution, or we change our ways and accept nature's dominion over us. All three options are valid. All three options are journeys that we can take depending on our point of view and aspirations. So let's take each option and see where it leads us. Option 1. let the status quo continue. We are agents of entropy. Our current course of parasitizing the Earth of its species and dignity is right on according to the second law of thermodynamics. In broad terms, this law indicates that entropy or haphazardness in a system like Earth increases with the use of energy. And we are the biggest per capita users of energy on Earth. So what should we expect? Major extinctions do happen, and at present our only tool to predict that it is happening right now is science, which tells us that it is most likely so. And now we must come to the uneasy subject of death. All life forms are agents of entropy, and death indeed is a process all life on Earth experiences. The death we are facing here is that of millions of species and thousands of ecosystems. No matter how immense the event, it is a procedure of recycling that lays the foundation for new life. Nothing is lost. For example, the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event 66 million years ago laid the groundwork for the evolution of humans and their cohabitant species. Atoms and molecules simply move around and eventually return to the land. By doing so, they get ready to bring forth new species and biomes with the help of the sun. As far as our intellect and consciousness are concerned, they will be deleted from the universe forever, along with many vestiges of the voyage that got us to this tragic shore we find ourselves on today. It is necessarily so, simply because we rejected nature's ways and wrought against them with alien ideas. Ideas such as water shouldn't meander, and that the secret to happiness on this planet is the accumulation of wealth and the spread of prosperity. And so from the soil will spring forth new species, ecologies, intellectuals, and consciousness. Only nature knows of their kind. We can only hope that these new life forms are nature lovers for at least a while, and realize that they are all an integral part of a fresh new world. Option 2. Come up with a better system. Don't even think about that. Nature is complicated and hard for humans to understand. So how can we come up with a better system? Our ignorance is how the alien parasites grabbed onto our brains and hormones, declaring humans do not belong to nature. In addition, humans are incapable of forming any successful large society or economy as observed in Nal, the current political and economic turmoil. We simply evolved to be tribal people, meaning we are only able to form successful relationships within small groups. That is why we, the civilized, have so much history consumed in mega conflicts and drama. Option 3. Return to nature. Indigenous tribes, like those of the forest people, are the salvation of the planet Earth. They live without damaging their environments. They have a nature-based ecological footprint. It is criminal what is being done to them and their habitats. At the time they were researched in the 1950s by Colin Turnbull, there were approximately 5 million of them living in the Congo River Basin. Today there are less than 500,000. This situation needs to change. We were once noble beings, fulfilling our needs through our attitudes and actions under the guidance of nature and its limitations upon our physical and mental capabilities. Limitations that guided us in our participation in nature's cycles. The birth of science gave birth to technology and then economic theory. Each of these births cheated us out of our natural contribution to the well-rounded actions that kept us in sync with the orchestra of life on Earth. The birth of science did so by amplifying our needs and fears through actions that overcame the limitations set by nature. 8 billion people are unsustainable on Earth. It not only disallows nature to take its cyclical and balanced course, but is driving the extinction of a plethora of species, including possibly our own. Nor can we pretend that scaling down our present systems to half or a third of their sizes is going to do it. That will only prolong the agony of the inevitable. We need to have a proven approach to the problems at hand. We need to bow our heads to nature because it was the way things had worked in the past, and that needs to work in the future. The following 5 action items will help save the planet from a predicted 6th mass extinction event. The actions we need to take. First, we need to do away with the written word. This will exorcise the parasites from our bodies and minds. It will shed our economies, along with our sciences and technologies, immediately from our consciousness, and construct cultures that are more in tune with nature, occupied by song, dance, skit, and oral traditions. Cultures that embrace nature's cyclical and balanced environments as an equal partner in sustaining the life of all species within. To do so, we must adapt a hunter-gatherer lifestyle or something similar to help naturally sustain our environment. Second, an armchair estimate indicates we need to reduce the size of the human population to a naturally sustainable level of less than 10 million. We can do this by stopping all births and letting the death rate climb from the current 7.6 to 39.95 deaths per thousand per year. For example, when we stop using fossil fuels as a consequence of not using technology, most, if not all, health, food, and transportation facilities will shut down and nature will take its course. Deaths from poor health, starvation, and inability to secure an income will lead to an increase in the death rate. This will bring the population down to 10 million in 25 years. Once this is achieved, the population can start giving birth to offset deaths once again. Third, while this is happening, the remaining population should migrate toward areas where it is possible to live without any fossil fuels. This is needed because it is where we evolved, and it is where we can more easily thrive. Anywhere else, it will be harder to live without fossil fuels to keep us warm in winter and cool in summer. Fourth, to make tools, they should only be made of local resources. For example, to make a hatchet, only local wood, bone, or stone should be fashioned to fit its intended purpose. Fifth, only use the sun's energy that exists above ground. This includes the direct rays of the sun and their storage in objects like wood, twigs, or leaves. For example, to cook our food, we should only use wood readily available above the ground, and not natural gas, which requires technology. By following and sticking to these five action items, a cultural framework should spontaneously evolve that supports them along with a cyclical balanced relationship with nature. It may help to realize that any thoughts that diverge from the above five action items, as planted in our brains by the alien parasites whose intentions are to consume the earth by using us as tools to do so. It is time we face our shortcomings that are eclipsed by an overinflated ego. The domains of nature and that of the civilized are discordant. The domain of nature is where we belong, and there we must return. So, let the chips fall where they may. When we immediately stop and abandon our civilized cultures, no matter where they exist, because they are the kernel of all Earth's problems. Stop all current economic activities. Technology has betrayed planet Earth, so we must ban it from our lives. Abandon all science, for it also has betrayed us and the Earth by being the oracle for self-fulfillment. Therefore, it needs to be banned from our lives and the world forever. By doing so, we accept the truth of nature and return to a dignified life. We accept that our current lives are expendable for the sake of the greater planet and whatever remains of life on it. Earth's symphony orchestra of life will be short of already extinct species, but the music created by the remainder will still be enthralling and will continue instead of dying into silence. To prevent it from doing so, we must take off the cap of the civilized and put on the hat of altruists. Only then will the truth be known, a truth only the hunter-gatherer knows. The truth is revealed in every song they sing, in every dance step they take, and in their acceptance of their obligation to the down-to-earth environments and ecosystems they live in. If you are not convinced, turn to your web search engine to help in the hunt for the truth and pursue resources on so-called primitive tribes that have survived for thousands of years in harmony with their environments. On a personal level, the first step to take is abstention from the use of the written word, and if that is not possible, then the reduction in its use. The second step is not to have any babies for a few years, and if that is not possible, then to have fewer babies if possible. This should set us on a path that will help us deal with the rest of what needs to be done. It will be a much harder step to maintain a frame of mind generation after generation to support these actions. How can we prevent ourselves from slipping back into using the written word, technology, fossil fuels, or medications once again? How can we accept natural death as a valid outcome of our existence and the survival of the species? Can we set up a challenge-free belief systems to safeguard against the regression into civilized habits and ways of living? What would that belief system look or sound like? After all, science has a mean grip on our psyche, where it encourages the birth of harmful ideas and lifestyles. Have we, the civilized, painted ourselves into a corner? And if so, is it justified that all the civilized must be sacrificed to let the indigenous tribes flourish and thrive with their nature-based beliefs? If we are successful in turning things around, we will have a better future that is less complicated by an amalgam of alien taboos and draconian rules. We will be free to live the way nature intended for us to live. Epilogue. This publication aims to show that we need to slow down the pursuit of greater entropy on the planet Earth. At the current pace, a degree of entropy or chaos will be reached sooner that is unlivable by most, if not all, current species on our planet. There are four characteristics of civilized economics involving capitalism and technology. First, it is human-centric. Second, it is based on a value system. Third, it required management. Fourth, it inflated the ego, giving it the illusion of great power. All four characteristics are unnatural and will lead to the dissolution of life as we know it on the planet. To save the Earth before it is too late, we need to decide now. Humbled by nature, we must follow it in everything we do. We must join the cyclical and balanced communities of the Earth once again. The battle is between nature and the civilized. Out of the three options presented in the previous chapter, option 3, return to nature, will be the default choice for returning Earth to a sustainable state once again. It will be so because it provides hope in saving the natural beauty all around us. Hope is an essential and positive component of the human psyche. Without it, there is only despair and no real reason to continue living. Those who can see the forest from the trees have a vision of hope that is different than what the rest of us can see. It is therefore the responsibility of those who have hope in their hearts to help by making sure a beautiful future is in sight. Note: this audiobook is taken from the book How to Save the Earth by Hassan Rashid, ISBN 9798308483 76. Copyright 2025 by Hassan Rashid, all rights reserved. No part of this book may be reproduced or transmitted in any form by any means, graphic, electronic, or mechanical, including photocopying, recording, taping, or by any information storage retrieval system without the author's written permission. Contact ostamed@yahoo.com.